trying to get press and attention, just because a lot of websites and stuff are themselves kind of a little morbid these days. I spoke to my former publicist, Judy, and she was saying that it's just been so hard on her end just getting attention for new releases. So
yeah, it's interesting because I work in radio. I've heard that the radio platforms and folks listening to content in its entirety has gone up, whereas the sort of more passive streaming has gone down. The thought behind that is maybe that folks have more time to dedicate in a block and less of the little kind of pieces of commuting that they maybe tuck streaming into. But yeah, I don't know what that dedicated time looks like what state of mind, or whether people are really excited during those blocks, or it's hard to gauge.
Yeah, it's difficult to really tell. I did see across the board that there was a very positive response to the record's release on the part of listeners. People were really, really enjoying it and really grateful that it was out, both the video that we released to accompany the first single as well as the record itself.
So in terms of how you're spending your time, I assume that also looks different during this time, though I have found some musicians that I've talked to, I guess, has spent some time in some form of social isolation throughout the year anyway. So some of them have been doing okay in that side of it. But how have you been doing during this time?
When quarantine first started, there was definitely a good 4 or 5 weeks where I was completely adrift. I was cooking a lot and the food I was making was delicious. But aside from that, I just felt the days were slipping away. I realized that it was like I would wake up, I'd make a coffee, and I'd wake up early, like 7 a.m., make a coffee, and then suddenly just look at the clock and it would be 7 p.m. And it was like I wasn't getting anything done. I think it was just kind of a bit of a latent depression. And it's not just that, you know, day-to-day life has changed because of lack of direct social contact with people. It's also just this kind of feeling I have of hopelessness when I think about, you know, going on tour again. Because I just know that even though businesses may reopen, that we may start to be able to travel again, that really going on tour is going to be probably the last thing that comes back. I don't see people wanting to go to shows anytime in the future, anytime soon, and that's kind of scary. And it can affect just my moment-to-moment desire to make music, my motivation to. Happily, because I'm not just working as on my own songwriting stuff, but I'm also do film composing and arranging, and I've had other stuff to keep me occupied, just client work. So after that kind of period of strange moribundity, I was able to kind of get back on the horse. And I do agree when you say that musicians, certain of them, may express actually kind of a bit of a familiarity with what is happening. And I believe that to be the case with myself as well. Because functionally, I was already spending most of my time alone working on music. And so that aspect hasn't really changed. I think the biggest change for me has been just the relationship that I have to my friends, because my friends have themselves been in different states of mind and a little more distressed and in need of more emotional support and attention. And so, yeah, just adjusting to accommodate that has been something.
Yeah, I'm hoping that folks are starting to settle into a bit of give and take in that regard, that it's unusual for everybody to need support at once. In my experience, usually if one of us is struggling, or even a couple of people, there's a handful of other people who are doing pretty all right to balance that out. And you expect over a larger span of time for friendships to give and take. But right now, folks have to try to find the capacity to do both of those things all at once.
Yeah. And I mean, there's different types of support for different types of feelings, right? Because most of the time when I've been communicating with friends about stuff they've been going through or stuff I've been going through, a lot of it is dealing with distortions and just people having anxieties that are maybe founded but are being felt in exaggerated ways. However, what we're facing is like very real. An unprecedented number of people have been dying, and there's immense amounts of you know, just a degradation of everyone's personal wealth. It's been a very real problem. And the way that you deal with real problems, in my experience, has been through practicing acceptance. And this involves, you know, stuff like meditation, stuff like exercise, self-care sort of things. So it's been really important to me to really try to make sure that I'm taking time to care for my body, care for my mind. And when I slip up and I spend a week with no exercise or drinking every day, then yeah, then my mental health suffers.
Have you found, because there's more of a universal understanding that this is traumatic and not exaggerated, is it easier for folks to talk about the fact that they're struggling, especially people who maybe traditionally feel embarrassed or guarded about admitting to those types of feelings?
I haven't noticed that, no. But I don't think that it's because people are feeling embarrassed or guarded. I think that it's just, it's difficult to really talk about it and have it be compelling. We're not really in a place right now where there's much to talk about. And I think that's part of the reason why people have been kind of succumbing to latent depression, is when there's no stimulus in your life except the TV shows you've been watching and things that you've read on the internet. And maybe you had a nice walk in the sunshine, you can't really gossip or discuss. There's nothing really to talk about. So I think that everyone is just kind of feeling lonely and unstimulated, and it's hard to really express that or find any sort of an outlet or correction for that, because things just aren't really changing. It doesn't feel like things have been changing.
Yeah, one thing I sort of observed is I think a lot more people throughout the day normally would have asked things like, how are you doing? Or what have you been up to? And even if at times it had been annoying to go through the same motions of a little bit of sharing to a lot of people around sort of just a base level, I think that when no one asks, how are you doing or what are you up to, then there's actually a weird bottled up feeling. Like when I do get the opportunity to talk to somebody, it shocks me how much comes out, and I think just because it's had nowhere to go.
Yeah, no, that's very true too. There's something that I've noticed, you know, because I have already stated that I myself exist in a state of isolation as I work, and my relationship to my social circle is unique within the social circle because most of my friends aren't musicians. So I feel a little bit at a loss from time to time, and sometimes I feel very lonely if I'm not getting text messages about, you know, the barbecue that's happening or something like this. And I think that now it's just everybody's kind of feeling the same way, where you're just waiting for people to check in and say hello, not even thinking to yourself, oh, I can be the one who checks in and says hello. I've always tried to, if I'm having periods in my life where I am feeling socially isolated prior to quarantine, if I'm having periods in my life where I am feeling socially isolated or lonely, I try to combat that with taking more proactive role in creating social events like dinner parties or movie nights and stuff like that, just to kind of have those outlets. But these days, I don't know, the charm of Zoom conversations is worn off, the charm of games nights with online games is kind of worn off, even the charm of cooking it's kind of like I'm just like, oh, I just want to make a pizza and smoke a joint and not think.
Yeah, I've experienced some similarities. I was cooking a lot on the front end as well. It's interesting though. I feel like some of the things that took off right away are being replaced by things that feel a little bit more repeatable or sustainable. Like my state now feels like it could go on for a longer period of time sufficiently. And the front end was a lot of experimenting with what was going to work and how long will we be in this. I don't know if you've settled into a rhythm, and I don't know if that's a good thing, but...
Because I had the album release, which was kind of an event in my life, it's hard for me to really gauge any sort of rhythm, because that kind of was like a big thing that kind of was preoccupying my mind. But I definitely remember early in the quarantine, like maybe 3 or 4 weeks in, I was speaking to my friend Harmony, and she said, we need to get to a point where we're not just surviving, but we're thriving. And I really took that to heart. We are in a position right now where we can be thriving, where we can find things to occupy our time that will help other people, that might generate income. We just need to kind of like work hard to find out what those things are and engage with them.
Have there been any new things that have emerged in what you're up to that have surprised you or that have been really positive?
No, not particularly. Most of the projects that I've been working on were kind of either stuff that have been long under discussion or kind of came up but were not unexpected. So, no, I've just been doing client work, film scoring, stuff like that. And the record release itself was a very interesting and unique experience, just putting out a record with no touring around it or, you know, it was kind of a funny time.
Well, I'd love to ask you more about that because I've actually been surprised talking to people about how much of a variation there is in terms of how much the audience or the tour is the reason. I've talked to musicians who it's an inevitability, it's part of the system, it's part of their job, but the recording itself or the writing is the part that is really the special piece, and the other part is a responsibility that comes along with it. And then other folks who it's all about performing and touring, and the record is an excuse to get to continue that. And where do you fall on that kind of scale?
I think that both touring and recording present a kind of a set of challenges and a set of rewards. For me, the act of songwriting and recording and releasing the album is very, all the pleasures are in the front end. I derive the most amount of pleasure from the process in the very early creative stages when I'm mapping out how I want the record to work, when I'm writing the songs, when I'm finishing a lyric. There's really no greater feeling of self-fulfillment than when I play a song that I've recently completed for a friend and ask their opinion. It's that kind of early creative stage that I find really rewarding. And the flip side of that is the actual release of a record is very much of a challenge, because all of this time and energy that you've spent in preparing this collection of songs is now out in the world, and you're, you know, if you choose to read it and choose to engage with it, as I do, then you have to respond internally to the very real thing that happens, which is people judge you and people think about your and talk about your music. And these are not necessarily people who are good actors or people who care about you personally. So it can be a challenge to have to remind yourself that this record that you wrote in isolation, that you shared with your friends, is now something that has to exist in the public eye. And the flip side of that is touring. Touring is like a very rewarding experience for about an hour a day. Because I've always tried to really express this to people, because I think it's really important that the world know that touring is a job. It is a job. It is not only a job, but it's a job where there's an 8-hour commute every day. You have to pick up, you have to drive 8 hours to work or take a plane to your next destination. You play the show and then you have to pack up, you have to check into a hotel, or a motel, or find friends to crash with, or however it is that you're doing it. It's work. It's a lot of work. And it's kind of almost a bit of a net negative in terms of mental health. Like, I think it wears on you more than it rewards. But there is nothing more rewarding than having that moment when you step in front of a crowd of people and you're able to play your songs for them and feel a kind of a real-time appreciation for the work that you do. It's kind of the moment that keeps you going. It's not the applause so much, it's just this feeling of communion, with feeling like you've done something that is worth people's time and is sustaining people on a kind of a spiritual level. That is the reward of touring. So being denied that, it's also how musicians make money, because streaming services just do not pay. They do not pay. YouTube does not pay. I mean, they pay, but they don't pay enough to guarantee a living wage, even for a musician with my kind of like C-list or D-list level of visibility. It's not enough. And so touring is kind of like how you supplant that income, how you actually end up paying the bills. And not having that is both hard on the ego, because you don't have that sort of like expression of appreciation for the work that you've done. And it's also hard on your bank account, because I'm not making any money off this record.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you described the work piece behind touring, because I think that especially non-musicians, I think, kind of bundle the tour life all together for a lot of different levels. And I think it looks very different. Like, your description of touring is relatable, but looks very different than my own. And I think I can picture easier ways to replace my shows that would have only had maybe 20 people at them anyway in the new reality, but you would have probably had like fairly large audiences. Like, what was the typical size when you tour a venue?
It changes from market to market. I pretty consistently guarantee that I'll be playing to, you know, 1,000 people in Toronto and maybe 600 or 800 in Montreal and New York and Los Angeles and San Francisco. I do pretty well in certain pockets in Europe, and I do reasonably well considering my level of visibility in Asia, which is just an entirely different market. There are certain places where it's just like so disappointing that I don't know why I would never go back there, like Australia. But it's the thing is that, as you know, Jenny, I've toured with Arcade Fire. Like, I've been every night in front of a 10,000 person crowd in an arena. And I don't think that mental health wise that there's really anything more rewarding or easy when the audiences get larger. I've had conversations with members of Radiohead where they're belly aching about the same things that I would belly ache about. Mm-hmm. It continues to be a challenge. And this is not at all to suggest that I'm not appreciative. Of course, I'm hugely appreciative. It's just I wish people kind of would understand just that it is a lot of work. Mm-hmm. I had a boyfriend who I dated for 13 years, Patrick, who you know, Jenny. And when we first started dating and I was doing touring, I remember that he would kind of get a little, like he'd be a jerk to me for a week leading up to the tour and then a week when I got back. And I didn't understand why he was doing this. And I spoke to a friend of mine, Matt Smith, and Matt said, well, he's jealous. Like, he sees you going away and he sees you traveling and he misses you. And he also kind of, you know, is envious of like this lifestyle. So I ended up taking him out on tour, and he joined the Arcade Fire tour in January 2005. So we would have been dating for almost 2 years at this point. And this was his first time coming out on tour. And I remember the first day that he was just like enthralled and had this great time. And then he got incredibly drunk after the show on the rider on all the booze that the, you know, was paid for as part of the budget. And I remember by the time that we got to LA that just before I went on stage, I told him, so we have a 5 a.m. call tomorrow. We have to be up at 5 a.m. just so you know. So after the show, we've got to pack up and get out right away so we can get like 3 or 4 hours sleep. And I remember it was at the Troubadour in L.A., and when you're standing on stage at the Troubadour, the merch table is in another room, but you can see right through a window right to where the merch table is. So while I was playing, I was able to see Patrick sitting at the merch table, and I saw him there and played my set, and he just sat there crying. He was just crying. He had no idea how difficult it was. And to just be told, like, yep, we get 3 hours of sleep tonight. And I mean, this is also, too, it's just like, you know, people want to talk about a rock star lifestyle leading to, you know, substance abuse, but it's very real. It's when you're out on tour and it's lonely and the work is really hard. The only thing, the only source of comfort sometimes is alcohol. And it's largely why, including myself, people can develop problematic relationships to alcohol. I remember there was one tour I was on, and this was would have been Arcade Fire in 2013. And after every show, I would look at the rider and the promoters would have gotten a nice bottle of wine, like a $50 bottle of wine or something. And I'd look at it and I'd be like, oh, that is too nice of a bottle of wine for it to go to waste. And I'd drink a couple of glasses, and 2 glasses of wine is not too much for me. But when you're drinking 2 glasses of wine every day, it starts to kind of have, you know, these kind of long-term effects on like your relationship to booze. And I remember when we finally arrived on the tour in Paris, I was, because I like wine, I was walking to a wine store with the intention of buying a couple of nice bottles to bring back to Patrick, to my then boyfriend. And I remember as the bottles were coming into focus and seeing the price tags attached to them, I thought to myself, I would pay that amount of money to not have this wine in front of me. Like, I had just become so kind of poisoned by, you know, the need for alcohol, the availability of free alcohol. So, yeah. And that was kind of the beginning of a on-again, off-again struggle that I have with my relationship to alcohol, which, you know, I'm sure that you can relate to either in a first or a second-hand way.
Yeah. Well, the fascinating thing about quarantine is I definitely heard some folks expressing that I guess they have more access or more time to be indulging in things like drinking, but for some folks it's made it easier, the absence of other people to drink with and the sort of social pressure element that is part of it for some people. This has been more of a break. And I mean, I personally biologically had 2 periods of being pregnant while touring where I didn't drink at all. So I feel like I've had experience with a big block of time that looks different alongside everyone else drinking. I'm wondering if people on the other side of a quarantine are going to think about what they bring back into their life. Like, if this is an opportunity to purge without the pressures in some regards, and if coming back in, they're going to have moments like you describe of looking at the bottle of wine and realizing they don't want it to come back.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, my relationship to alcohol is quite simple. I don't have a drinking problem unless I'm drinking. So when I'm sober and I'm not drinking, I'm totally fine. I don't even really feel an impulse to do so. And for a long time, I think maybe the first 2 months of quarantine, I don't think I had more than one drink. Like, I was maybe having a drink a week. Like, it was very, very rare. And but then when I did, because you're at home, you just drink the whole bottle of wine. So I just kind of was keeping booze out of the house, and it was good for my mental health. Recently, because, you know, celebrating the album release and stuff like that, I've been indulging a little bit, and to mixed results. It's drinking is not the same when you're not doing it on a patio with friends, when you're just kind of like at home by yourself or with your partner, and, you know, it can kind of lead to less positive states of mind. I have been smoking more weed. Almost every day I'll have a couple of puffs of a joint before bed, and that has been a net positive. But I'm not a heavy weed smoker, so just even a little bit is just the spice of life.
So I don't know if you'll have experienced this or not, but the last week or so, I've found myself, it's almost like if this period of time was sifting and the different priorities or activities I would usually get up to were in this big pile of all impossible. It's like this been this mental sifting where certain things have emerged as being the things I either missed the most or the things I'm most excited to figure out how to bring back when I get to go back to something like normal. Have there been priorities or interests that have kind of risen above some of the other things when you've had this much time with yourself?
A couple of things, yeah. I mean, one of the side effects of working as a musician and kind of being isolated for your work, at least in my case, is that you tend to also indulge in solitary pleasures. So pretty much once a year, when I felt like I needed to take some time off, I would fall into video game mode, and I would just like play Civilization 6 for a week and not really leave the couch. And that was kind of like my version of a vacation. Now that I've been in this quarantine situation where video game.
You're listening to C101.5 FM, The Hawk, from Mohawk College in Hamilton, Ontario. Hamilton's alternative.
Can harm you. Daddy and Mammy standing by.
Good evening. You're listening to Center Stage, a celebration of musicals from both the stage and screen. I'm your host, Lila Miklosh. Tonight on the show, we're going to have an in-depth interview with Karen Anchetta and Aaron Jan, two of the co-producers behind The Garden Project, an initiative for BIPOC performance artists here in Hamilton. And throughout the hour, we're going to hear music in celebration of summer from Broadway. We started off the hour with Paul Robeson singing Summertime from Porgy and Bess. Next up, from Greece, Olivia Newton-John and John Travolta and Company with Summer Nights. You're listening to 101.5 The Hawk.
Summer loving had me a blast.
Summer loving happened so fast.
I met a girl crazy for me.
Summer nights. Oh, well, oh, well, oh, well, oh, tell me more, tell me more. it's too darn hot. I'd like to sup with my baby tonight. Refill the cup with my baby tonight. I'd like to sup with my baby tonight. Refill the cup with my baby tonight. But I ain't up to my baby tonight, 'cause it's too darn hot. It's too darn hot. It's too darn hot. I'd like to cool with my baby tonight. And pitch the woo with my baby tonight. I'd like to coo with my baby tonight. And pitch the woo with my baby tonight. But brother, you fight my baby tonight, 'cause it's too darn hot. According to the Kinsey Report, every average man you know much prefers his lovey-dovey to court when the temperature is low. But when the thermometer goes way up and the weather is sizzling hot, Mr. Pants for romance is not, 'cause it's too, too, too darn hot. It's too darn hot. It's too, too darn hot. Baby tonight, and pitch the woo with my baby tonight. I like to coo with my baby tonight, and pitch the woo with my baby tonight. But brother, you fight my baby tonight, 'cause it's too darn hot. According to the Kinsey Report, every average man you know much prefers his lovey-dovey to court when the temperature is low. But when the thermometer goes way up and the weather is sizzling hot, Mr. Gob for his squad, a Marine for his queen, a GI for his cutie pie is not, 'cause it's too, too, too darn hot.
You're listening to The Hawk, 101.5 FM in Hamilton, Ontario.
You're listening to Center Stage, a celebration of musicals from both the stage and screen. I'm your host, Lila Miklos, here on 101.5 The Hawk. On the phone with me right now are Aaron Jan and Karen Anchetta, and they are two of the co-producers of The Garden Project. And Aaron, would you like to start off with telling us what The Garden Project is?
So The Garden Project is a crowdfunded initiative that kind of exists for Karen, myself, who are Porchlight Theater, and Matt McFadgen, Anna Chariton, Rick Banville, Laura Welch, and Rose Hopkins, who are industry, to give 4 seed money grants to BIPOC performance-based Hamilton creators. So we are literally giving away north of $10,000 to 4 individuals or 4 teams to make something this summer.
And BIPOC stands for Black Indigenous Person of Color.
Correct.
Why did you see a need to create this grant?
Karen, do you want to speak to this?
Sure. Growing up in Hamilton, both Aaron and I, actually, we had to go away to work, to learn, to train. Unfortunately, there is not very much infrastructure here. There's more in Toronto. So in some ways, development for artists and creators, for BIPOC creators, there's not really a lot here. So we sort of want to be the thing that we crave, actually, and we want to support the local artists here.
You are part of a theater company called Porchlight, Karen?
Yes, that's correct. We're a Hamilton-based collective dedicated to the development and support of youth, of both emerging and professional theater artists and storytellers. And we exist to build a space that amplifies the voices of marginalized theater artists from the greater Hamilton area. And we're interested in taking their stories and playwriting explorations to the next level of development.
Awesome. I'm loving it. So when I go and look at Industry Presents Garden Project page, it says, the Garden Project is an initiative in partnership with Porchlight Theatre that aims to commission as many Hamilton-based BIPOC artists as possible with seed money to write or develop new work. And each artist will be paid an honorarium of $2,000 and paired with a dramaturg mentor of their choice who will be paid for their consultation. Erin, we had been talking about that you were looking for calls for applications. Can you talk to us about the application process?
Oh, it's super simple. So all they have to do is email us at the email on the website, and they have to give a maximum 500-word description of the project they want to work on in the language of their choice, and give us a maximum 3-minute video or maximum five-page writing sample of what they're going to work on. We're accepting applications from all performance-based disciplines. So if you are a jingle dancer, if you are a spoken word artist, if you do popping or breakdancing, if you write plays, if you're a storyteller, any BIPOC artist with a Hamilton-based practice who has a performance element to their work and wants to make something new, they're eligible.
And folks have till July 10th to submit.
That is correct.
That's correct.
Now, on your industrypresents.com Garden Project page, I see the names Josh Taylor and Jessica Leah Fleming. Can you tell us a little bit about these two artists?
Sure. We really wanted to assemble a jury of folks to evaluate the applications who represented like all the beautiful intersections that are in Hamilton. Josh is an incredible dancer. Jessica is the Métis playwright in residence at Theatre Aquarius with a long, long practice with companies all over Canada. So, and we have yet to announce the final two jurors. Probably by the time this goes up, they will be announced. It was really important for us to kind of make sure that the majority of the producers were not on the jury, just so we could kind of continue to give back to the community that way. That even though we've raised the money, we don't have like a critical say on this jury who gets this money, that we're handing it over to a group of interdisciplinary BIPOC artists themselves who will determine that.
And are you still accepting donations towards the Garden Project?
Yes. You can go to the industry website, and there is a, in the right top corner, there is a button for donate. We are accepting donations. Even though we've hit our goal, we're really hoping that this project can keep going. I think this is something that is much needed, and from what I've heard from a lot of people, the reception is excellent, and we're hoping that we can keep this going and just keep supporting BIPOC artists for years to come. We'll see what happens. This is the first step, though. It's just a small step, but in all the time that I've been here in Hamilton, it's a big step. It's a big step in the right direction, I think.
Mm-hmm. If I can just add on to Karen's point, too, it's like it's really important to me that artists get paid in this city and that we don't have to depend on like another body to do that. That like, in my experience in Toronto, the professional work I've received has been through funding that I've fought for myself, funding I've applied for myself. And if this project can kind of create a feeling that, like, Hamilton-based BIPOC artists can apply for funding, we can start to nurture a professional community that pays its artists. Because that's, I love this city, but one thing I think is missing from it is independent creators getting paid for their work. And this, to me, is a crucial first step in that eventual enrichment of our city.
And do you have any thoughts as to why Hamilton has such a lack of professional paid theater? There's lots of community theater going on, but as for professional, why there's a lack of that happening?
I think for myself, there's a myriad of reasons. I think the first is there's a bit of a lack of education in the city about eligibility for grants and applying for grants and how it's not that difficult to win grants. So some of the work I've been doing over this break has been educating some Hamilton artists about how to apply for funding. So I think there's a lack there. I also think that venue is a big thing, that a lot of companies in Toronto that are professional theaters have venues. The only professional theater with a venue in town is Theatre Aquarius, who, frankly, they have their own priorities in filling their giant house. So because their priorities aren't necessarily aligned yet with local BIPOC artists, I think there's that's where the discrepancy lies. Because the community theaters have venues themselves, and they have different priorities than creating professional opportunities for folks, you kind of have these, I don't want to say homeless, but like venue-less professional theater companies in town. Mm-hmm. So the visibility of them is lesser, and as a result, because there's no real greater sense of venued community in town for professional independent theaters, I think that's where that lack comes from. I don't know, Karen, what do you think?
So my sister, Vancouver, she's a musician, and she told me that she noticed how in Hamilton, a lot of artists have a lot of passion, and they're really happy to work for free. And when she moved to Vancouver, she kind of found the same, but that over the 15 to 20 years that she's been there, artists started to band together, and they started to demand more. I guess there's a more of a recognition that art and artistry is work, and it deserves to be paid. So like 20 years later, she can actually make a living as a musician in Vancouver. And I'm kind of hoping that people will see their works and maybe demand more, and that it will change in Hamilton, because art and artistry, the amount of time that people devote to it, it really should be recognized. You should be able to make a living. People do make a living in Toronto. I mean, you do have to have sometimes supplementary, but you can make work and get paid for it in Toronto. So hopefully it will change here also.
And I should, full disclosure here, Karen and her sister Mary and I all went to Hill Park together.
That's right.
And we did musical theater, and I remember seeing Karen when I was just a munchkin at Cardinal Heights, and she was playing the narrator in Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat when my school came.
My school came
for their school trip to come and see the high school musical.
That's amazing. Oh, my gosh. It's one of my fondest memories, honestly. And then the people that ran the program, Bill Cook and Sylvia Hollinati, they really, really they really cared, and they nurtured us, and they gave us the gift of just exposing us to musicals and theater. I'll never forget those experiences that I had in high school.
How about for you, Erin? When did the theater bug hit you?
Oh, geez. So my mom put me in camps when I was young, which sounds very scary, but it was, the whole idea was essentially a camp where you made a play throughout the week. Then on the final day of the camp, you would put it up in front of friends and family. And I just remember that adrenaline rush the one day we presented, and just sitting backstage and just like feeling something in my gut saying that, like, you want this, you need this. So I always go back to that as kind of that moment that made me really want to chase this, that there's an adrenaline rush I get before a show. Regardless of if I'm asking it, I don't act anymore, but regardless of like if I'm asking it or waiting for it to open, that I don't experience anywhere else. So like it's a weird thing that like I'm an adrenaline junkie in that way, but like that's kind of what started my love of it. It was like, I'm 6 years old and I'm so excited for this thing, and there's so many things that could go wrong, and that's so exciting.
Actually, can I ask a question, Erin? I'm kind of curious. Is it hard to make the decision to go into the arts, like with in regards to like with your parents and growing up here?
Absolutely not. My family was so supportive.
That's so good.
Yeah. I'm so lucky for that, because I know that's not the case with a lot of East Asian families. That may not be the case, but in my case, they were incredibly supportive of every artistic decision I've made.
That's so wonderful. I wish more parents were like that. My parents were not as supportive in the beginning. They love the arts, and they liked us to perform karaoke and, you know, for family and stuff, but it wasn't, you know, they didn't come all the way around the world for us to come here to be artists. So it was a bit of a struggle, I have to say. But eventually, eventually they turned around and are supportive. I don't think they quite still don't quite get what my sister and I do as artists, but they enjoy it when they see the end result.
Well, and I think that's a common thread for a lot of parents. It's like, you're going to become a what? I thought you were going to become a doctor or a teacher.
Exactly.
And have a real job, right?
Well,
Yeah,
it's funny, actually, because, like, the moment I started making money in the arts, any doubt left their mind. So to loop it full circle, that's why I think it is so important to pay folks, just because, like, it is possible to make a living in the arts, and you don't need to depend on an institution per se to do so. You can apply for funding and get that money yourself, which is what I've been doing for the last few years.
Kudos. And Aaron, I do have to say, I have loved many a production that you've put on at the Hamilton Fringe over the years. And I was You're very welcome. And I was very disappointed when your production of Spring Awakening at HTI had to be postponed because of COVID. But I'm happy to hear that the plan is for it to happen in the fall, because that was the one show I was like super pumped and excited about. And I was excited to see what you did with it.
Thank you. In regards to that, it's funny because I know we've been talking about paid work this entire thing, and like Spring Awakening at HTI is an unpaid gig, and I swore I'd never do community theater, and lo and behold, I'm directing a community theater piece. But I think that's kind of what inspired me partially to do the Garden Project, because we were doing Spring Awakening and just seeing how much those 13 artists, I'm not even going to say community theater actors, those 13 artists cared in that room. And how excited they were in that room. Like, we were doing stuff I do in my equity room. We were doing table work. We were breaking down intentions. I worked them hard. And they were all ready to stand up and do the work. So I remember sitting there and being like, there's something in this city. People want to do the work. So, like, why don't we make it work? I think that production of Spring Awakening, whether it goes up or doesn't go up, I am so grateful that HDI took me on. I'm so grateful to, like, Rochelle and Dustin and Ran and the entire team for taking a chance on this kind of, like, snooty jerk from Toronto. But, yeah, it's my favorite musical of all time, and that's why I came back, and I really hope it comes back.
I hope so, too, because I was super pumped about that one, and then when the whole world blew up, and I was like, you know, so I'm excited to hear that the plan is for it to happen this fall, and crossing our fingers and toes that theater does happen. And both of you as theater artists, while this pandemic is going on, how are you feeling about the future of live theater right now?
Oh, boy. It's very interesting. I think the medium is morphing. Whether we like it or not. I was watching the Harvard Theater grads do their one of their projects online, and I was so aware that while I was putting on my dinner and turning on my laptop to watch this, it was an interesting feeling being able to do that and not have to drive all the way to Etobicoke to see it at the school. And it was such an interesting you could see the medium is morphing, and you can see the students being pressed to put this project on. It wasn't quite what they had originally intended, but there was so much beauty in what they did and innovation. And I was also aware that as this was playing, these young graduates who haven't even come out of school yet are already pioneers of this new crazy theater COVID medium. It's quite amazing how fast people are trying to survive, and out of it, this very interesting and beautiful medium is being born. Right now, it's quite incredible.
And Aaron, how about you?
It's interesting, actually, just because, like, I think we're trying to figure out how we're going to operate. By we, I mean the general theater community, which is strange speaking as the general theater community, because I am not the general theater community. But just thinking about, like, what can we do in these online spaces that is not just, I'm going to put up a reading on Zoom and then we're going to see how it goes. Like, how do we actually use Zoom or this live conference software as a storytelling medium? Like, that to me is what really excites me. Like, when Karen saw Humber Spectrum of Tomorrow Love, I know Chris directed them in a really immersive way that used the medium.
Chris Stanton, actually, yes. Who's the director of the Hamilton Fringe Festival at the moment.
Yeah, so I think that is where theater is heading in the next year or so. Honestly, I don't think we're going to be back till 2021. I mean, I'm optimistic because of spring and the fall potentially, But we also don't know if a second wave's happening, right? Like, yep. We don't know if that strange pig virus in Hong Kong that was, in China that was discovered.
I was just hearing about that the other day, too, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm. It seems everything this year is trying to kill us. So I don't know whether we will be back, but I also know that, like, if theater and live performance is to survive, it has to embrace the mediums it's using and not use them as a substitute for the stage.
Mm-hmm. I think right now also, I think we're really, it's crystallized what we miss and what makes live theater live theater. I think because we're starved for it right now. I'm really, really looking forward to the day when we can not go back to normal, but, you know, we can gather, we can experience and have the focus in the room and that energy that's so missing from Zoom. Like, it's right now I feel like that's what everybody's trying to figure out. How do we, what is that thing? Because we know it when we're in the theater and we're experiencing it, like from the stage or in the audience. I think all this meditation on that, when we come out of this, is just going to explode. I think it's just going to, like, the fear that happens, like, right after it is going to be incredible when we get back.
Now, talking about Zoom meetings, the Stratford Festival's been having lots of amazing online programming since this whole pandemic started and trying their best to make lemonade out of lemons. And I've sat through two amazing conversations. One was with a Black theater artist talking about their experiences working in this very, very, very white industry in Canada. Mm-hmm. And then another one was a roundtable discussion with Indigenous theater artists. And I wanted to ask you two to reflect. Right. There's a lot more conversations happening out in the open about the crap that BIPOC artists deal with on the daily when they're working in this industry. And I'm seeing this garden project being a reflection of that. There has been some intense discussions around a Black Lives Matter statement that Theatre Aquarius put out. Are there any thoughts or reflections on, you know, the realities of being a BIPOC theater artist, navigating theater in Hamilton, in Canada, that you'd like to share with our listeners?
That's big.
Well,
yes.
That's a big one.
That's a big one, Lila.
I think for myself, I am so glad Stratford has stood up. Like, that to me is, like, monumental. That the moment, I guess, their first BLM statement was criticized, that they handed their social media over to Black and Indigenous artists, that is so radical to me and so wonderful, because all these people who have felt excluded from this organization now have the chance to speak up on their platform, and some speaking up against the institution. I think that is such a powerful form of allyship. And I know there are detractors in the Stratford community, because Stratford's like a pretty, yikes, conservative town sometimes. Mm. But just also seeing the Facebook comments of a lot of their subscribers being so excited and devastated by these Black and Indigenous artists telling their truth and their stories, that, like, it makes me so optimistic. Like, that to me is a white institution being a leader and a solid ally. Like, I love that. I think that is so rich and so wonderful. In relation to Theatre Aquarius' post, yeah, I mean, I'll admit part of my impetus to approach Karen and approach industry about the Garden Project was kind of in a response to that, just because it felt like a blanket statement and it felt like Aquarius was also not really doing any actionable items, that they were just trying to say a statement and retreat. But then I also realized another thing. These stories, these In the Green Room stories, aren't new. They've happened to probably almost every BIPOC artist working in Canada. Like, a story like that has occurred, and it's been swept under the rug. I think something I'm really inspired about was an article by Obsidian's now former artistic director, Philip Aiken, where he said, that article's beautiful, where he talks about how his biggest failure at Obsidian was expecting these organizations to change, and that he shouldn't have been focused on that in his career. That's their problem. What he should be focused on is how do we make our BIPOC-run organizations powerhouses? And that really inspired me. So when I went to Karen, and then we all met with industry like 3 weeks ago, because the Garden Project literally started 3 weeks ago. We sat in a circle Thursday and talked about it, socially distanced, of course. We kept talking about building. Like, People are angry in this city. People are upset. They feel left out. So what can we build for them that supports them? So it's not all about pointing fingers. It's that, okay, they're going to deal with their stuff. Now let's build something. So while they're restructuring, we have a tower already built, making as many ladders and ramps as possible to get inside that tower.
Yeah, the Garden Project is essentially our action plan. We were upset that there was none. We became the thing that we wanted, to see in the city.
So if you build it, they will come.
Something that, like, I know as an East Asian artist, one of the things that the seven of us have been doing is we've been individually reaching out to BIPOC artists in the community and finding out who's out there and just having dialogues with them about the project and how we can support them. Just because I know that, like, when an open call goes out, it's not enough, especially if you're a marginalized artist who sees a call and immediately something clicks in your mind that it's not for you. So I think that's something that we really strive towards. Like, we create those connections on top of the call. Sorry, Karen, you're saying something?
I was just going to say, throughout this process for the Garden Project, like, I knew that outreach was important. I have done outreach with the Theater Aquarium Theater School, which I have to say, like, their community page looks completely different than the main stage page. The community page of the Theater Aquarius, I look at that and I think that's the theater they all belong to. That's the one. It's, you know, it's diverse. They've got many voices. I see how important outreach is. And it's a lot of work. Like, it's not something that you can do overnight. Like, Aaron's right. You can't just do, a BIPOC call, put it up and go, well, where are they? You know, like, we put up the call. They didn't show. I guess there's not that many of them. No, you actually have to work harder. Like, through this garden project, I've found in order to get applicants, we need, like Aaron said, contact people individually, seek them out. We need to go into the communities. We need to find connectors and people that know. They know their communities and people that deserve the support, and that is the work. I feel like, yes, we need representation on stage. We also need representation in the audience, and I'm so interested in the next few years, really, really reach out and, I don't know, like, I guess, together, all the communities put together could really, like, fill BIPOC Aquarius.
I can't remember which one of these theater threads that I saw on Twitter, but somebody brought up a well-known white institution of theater was putting on a play that had BIPOC characters and the story in it. And they said, where's the audience? Where's the audience? And they said, well, did you reach out to that community? Did you direct marketing to that community so they knew this play was coming on? Did you do some outreach and invite them to a special showing and so they can tell their community members, like, did you do the work? And the flippant responses they got were, you know, pretty gross. And it's like, well, if you want the audience, you have to work at it. You can't, they're not just going to magically show up, right? Like, that's the work, right? And, and it is true. I have found that, too, where people go, we did a call out for artists for whatever the thing is. And they're nothing but white people applied. And you'll be like, well, did you do a reach out to those communities? Because they're not really your you know, your peak, so to speak. So if you want them to be a part of it, you need to do the work and reach out to them one-on-one to make that
exactly
happen. Yeah.
The work needs to be about making people feel welcome and valued and also having the communities represented and their stories told. Like, who doesn't want to come and hear their stories being told? If you do that and reflect so many different facets of the community, of course they'll come out. But that has to happen, and it's a slow process. It's not going to happen overnight. Like, we have a lot of work to do.
And the other thing I often hear from my BIPOC friends is when they go into a space that's predominantly white, that's not safe space for them. So if you want to invite them into your space, there's layers of work that need to happen here, right? Because beyond tokenism, right? And
yeah.
there's a lot of layers of what outreach means, what making that safe space and welcoming for others really actually means. And it's a lot of work, and not a lot of people want to invest in that work.
But at the end of the day, like, I think the beautiful thing about that work is, like, if folks dedicate time and resources, because it's important that people get paid for that work too, the rewards are incredible, because you've not only financially, you've extended your community and grown it in terms of box office, but also you're letting, like, if you do this properly, you are having folks experience what a lot of us have experienced in the theater our entire lives. You're having people see themselves on stages, seeing heroes and villains, making themselves feel brave in the same way that, like, a lot of Caucasian audiences, and even audiences, Asian audiences too, have experienced for some time. That, like, we do theater because we want to feel brave, and I stand by that. No matter what the story is, no matter if the hero succeeds or fails or hurts people, we get courage from watching it to be brave. So, like, that to me is what makes me passionate about outreach, and not just theater, because the Garden Project is open to all performance disciplines, but